Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, Trump is continuing to stir the pot when it comes to Russia. A couple of moments yesterday of interest. One, sort of a offhanded comment in the context of a cabinet meeting.
Yeah, which one? I can't. My head is spinning right now.
Asked by a poll reporter whether Russia is still targeting the United States, president said, "Thank you very much." No.
Or then they said, or was he telling reporters to go? Because then Sarah Sanders tried to clear that. No, he was saying you need to go.
Uh huh.
Or he, did he say, I listened to it
thank
five
you very
times.
Much, no, no.
Thank you very much, no, go, is what I heard.
Uh-huh. Is this like that stupid thing we were doing 2 weeks ago with, what are the two words again? Is it,
a homophone?
Wait. No, the two words where people were hearing different words.
Oh.
Mike Scott.
Mike, thank God.
Please help.
Surrender.
Yeah. Laurel and Yanni.
Oh, Laurel and Yanni. Yeah, Laurel Yanni. Exactly.
Yanni.
No, go. Laurel Yanni. Which do you hear? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. So that was one issue. And then I thought his interview with Jeff Glor for CBS Evening News was not terribly problematic. It sort of reiterated his clarification from the day before. For example, President Trump tackling the issue of Russian meddling and who's responsible. It seemed to be pretty straightforward.
You say you agree with U.S. intelligence that Russia meddled in the election in 2016.
Yeah, but, and I've said that before, Jeff. I have said that numerous times before. And I would say that that is true, yeah.
But you haven't condemned Putin specifically. Do you hold him personally responsible?
Well, I would, because he's in charge of the country, just like I consider myself to be responsible for things that happen in this country. So certainly, as the leader of a country, you would have to hold him responsible, yes.
Okay. Well, but if we could just sort of rinse and repeat that 30-second exchange, I think we'd really get ourselves out of a lot of trouble and avoid a lot of unnecessary consternation. Trump went on also in that interview to give Glor a little bit, and the American people by extension, a little bit of insight in terms of what he said to Putin about Russian interference.
We're not going to have it, and that's the way it's going to be.
But he denies it. So if you believe U.S. intelligence agencies, is Putin lying to you?
I don't want to get into whether or not he's lying. I can only say that I do have confidence in our intelligence agencies as currently constituted. I think that Dan Coats is excellent. I think that Gina is excellent. I think we have excellent people in the agencies. And when they tell me something, it means a lot.
Those answers don't seem to rise to the level of a 911 emergency.
Who in the world is interviewing him?
Jeff Glor from CBS News.
Oh, the Dan Rather replacement? I don't know who these people are. I've never heard of them.
Who cares? Yeah, I mean, they're interchangeable parts. But that's the guy's
random
name.
Random white guy with a clean haircut.
It doesn't seem to me that those answers rise to the level of a 9/11 emergency, which is how Connecticut Senator Dick Blumenthal is describing the current state of play in the United States. We are in a 9/11 emergency. And, of course, the calls for hearings and the like. Trump also did, though, not exactly reiterate his clarification, his contraction, retraction. Although, you know, with Trump, he's always going to give himself high marks. But with respect to his view of his performance at that press conference in question.
Let me just, I totally disagree. I think I did great at the news conference. I think it was a strong news conference. You have people that said you should have gone up to him, you should have walked up and started screaming in his face. We're living in the real world, okay?
Okay. No, we are living in the real world. There's no question. I don't know that anybody was requiring him to go up and scream in Putin's face. I think we just wanted those who are, you know, not suffering from the proverbial Trump derangement syndrome. I think we just wanted him to give answers like the first two clips we played.
Right. And then solid, strong answers. I liked what I heard. Yeah, it's different than the last 2 days. That's all right.
I believe our
third time's a charm, right?
Russia interfered in the 2016 election. That's clear. I believe our intelligence agencies. I told Putin that we're not going to have it. We're taking steps to prevent Russia or any other adversary from interfering in the elections in 2018 and into the future. And that would have buttoned it up nicely.
The one issue we can't seem to solve is the Yanni Lani.
Laurel.
That's Laurel.
Yeah.
So is it no go, go no, or no no?
The first thing that the president said after the question was asked was thank you very much. And then he said, no, I'm not answering any more questions.
But why should this president have any credibility to Americans in what he says if, in fact, 24 hours later, or in this case, 3 hours later, the White House comes out and says, just kidding?
First of all, that's not what I said. I was interpreting what the president's intention was and stating the administration's policy.
They even asked her.
Trump whisper. Yeah. I mean, the idea of a president, any politician, clarifying a remark after the fact, yeah. Not exactly groundbreaking stuff here. So the D.C. press corps is also a bit over the top when it comes to this. But I don't know. Just go back and look at the first couple of minutes of that interview with Jeff Glor on CBS Evening News, mm-hmm. Mr. President, and just stay in that pocket. That's a good pocket. Stay right there.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and stories still coming out about the rescue of that soccer team from the cave in Thailand.
Yeah. They made their first public appearance yesterday. It was a 90-minute press conference. Medical staff were sitting next to them, and they pre-screened the questions because they didn't want to create any trauma for the boys. But they talked about how they went in. They went in there just because some of the soccer kids, some of the players had never been inside a cave. So the coach said, all right, let's go. So they were hiking in for about an hour and then realized, all right, it's time to go. And when they were walking out, the floodwaters had risen. So they didn't know what to do. So they went back 200 yards to find a place to sleep. And then they wanted to return to that spot the next day. But then that spot was flooded. They survived by drinking clean water off the walls. So they literally would lick the walls to get water. All of them lost between 6 to 10 pounds.
How many of them were eaten by other members of the team?
They didn't have an alive moment. Mm. No, they didn't have to do that. But and they just, when the rescuers finally came to them and found them, one kid thought he was hallucinating, you know, when that British diver found them.
The pedo guy, according to Elon Musk.
The pedophile. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Elon Musk, shame on him. But one kid thought that he was, one of the 14-year-olds thought that he was afraid to go home, and he told the nurse because he lied to his mom and told her that he was going to play soccer instead of going to in a cave. So he thought he was going to be grounded. And the lady said, the nurse said, don't worry, you're not going to be grounded. You're going to be fine.
But you're used to being in isolation.
Oh, in Thailand? Well, I was going to blog some of the bites.
No, I mean in a cave.
Oh, in a cave. Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, you're locked in your room. You're locked in a cave. The other thing I saw, which is interesting about that, how they decided the order which the boys would swim out. Mm-hmm. It wasn't based on, like, ability to get out of the cave, who's the strongest swimmer.
Yeah.
It was based on who lives the closest. It went, like, farthest to closest from the cave for the bike ride home.
Are you serious?
That's what they did. That's the story out about that.
Are you serious?
Yeah. You've got... you know, you got the longest commute, so I guess you can go first.
No, they decided whoever was strongest, because none of them knew how to swim. They taught them how to swim there.
No, there's a story.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not making that up. There's a story.
Whoever lives closest to
that
you
it was
first.
Based on distance from the cave. That was the order in which they swam out.
Well, all the kids say they want to be professional soccer players, but now they all said yesterday they want to become Navy SEALs.
Well, that's a huge improvement.
Yeah.
Much better.
And I know that you don't care, but somebody else out there might. They did get to see the World Cup final game because they missed the whole World Cup tournament.
Did that end?
Yes, it did. And France won 4-2 over. Who did they play, Dan?
Madagascar? I don't know.
Croatia.
Yeah.
All right.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. Question our own intelligence, but never believe Putin or Kim Jong-un. We'll talk about it when Freedom returns at 5.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So I'm a bit confused here. I don't know what to do. Maybe you can help me out. Our friend Jim Comey, he's a former FBI director.
Yeah. Did you read his book?
No. The Republican Congress has proven incapable of fulfilling the founder's design that ambition must counteract ambition. All who believe in this country's values must vote for Democrats this fall. Policy differences don't matter right now. History has its eyes on us. Differences don't matter right now. So
you think he was biased in his work or this newfound love came after he got kicked out of office?
Excuse me, this man has a higher loyalty.
Excuse
me. To the Democratic Party. And I'm, on the one hand, I'm being admonished to vote for the Democrats this fall. History is looking at me.
Yeah. They're watching you.
I feel naked with history peering at me, leering at me.
Stop looking at me that way. Please, history.
And then on the other hand, you got the head of the Democratic Party, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's going to be a member of Congress in January. And she's saying, the capitalism I've enjoyed so much is going away. More of AOC on firing line.
Now the economy is going pretty strong, right? There's roughly 4% unemployment, 3.9% unemployment. Do you think that capitalism has failed to deliver for working class Americans, or is no longer the best vehicle for working class Americans?
Well, I think the numbers that you just talked about is part of the problem, right? Because we look at these figures and we say, oh, unemployment is low, everything is fine, right? Well, unemployment is low because everyone has two jobs. Unemployment is low because people are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week and can barely feed their kids. And so I do think that right now, when we have this no-holds-barred, Wild West hyper-capitalism, what that means is profit at any cost. Capitalism has not always existed in the world, and it will not always exist in the world.
The proletariat revolution is upon us. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. With history looking at us, is it okay if we embrace Democrat control of Congress so Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can drive us into the Xanadu that is post-capitalist America? What do you think? I think it's exciting times. Should we vote Democrat?
Who is talking? They both sound like little girls.
Well,
that was
Margaret Hoover that kind of reconstituted firing line show, which is obviously pales in comparison to Buckley's program. But nonetheless, she got Ocasio-Cortez and she got her to opine on a range of issues. We heard her on the Middle East earlier in the week. Now we hear her on capitalism.
The Palestinian occupation camps, or what was she doing?
Right, the occupied territory. Now we hear on this topic, and capitalism, got to be the hyper-capitalism, not just capitalism, has to be pushed aside. This has raised concerns among some Democrats. Mentioned Joe Lieberman penned an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about that yesterday. And he went on Fox Business with Charles Payne to talk about it yesterday as well.
And if her win makes her into what Kellyanne Conway called the new face of the Democratic Party is not going to have a very bright future.
But do you?
Ooh. Wow.
Ooh.
Dissension in the ranks. That future may be a little bit better because they got a new slogan. The Democrats have unveiled their slogan for the midterms.
Oh, okay.
You ready for it?
Or should we take calls with what people think it should be? Well,
you can see if you can improve on this. I doubt it.
Well, let me write it down.
But you can see if you can improve on this if you'd like.
I'm ready.
Excuse me. You ready?
I'm ready.
The 2018 Democratic Party midterm election slogan is... Thank you, Maestro. For the people.
What?
Didn't get the rousing reaction expecting.
For the people?
For the people.
That's so bad. For the people?
For the people.
We're for the people?
Mm-hmm.
For the people shall decide? For the people shall be victorious when you vote Democratic? What? It needs something else.
That you don't think that's saucy enough?
No, that's horrible.
How do you think it compares?
For the people.
How do you think it compares to their previous slogan, which they scrapped, Better Deal?
Oh, that's what?
Better Deal.
Oh, because it sounded like.
Remember that?
Better Deal.
No.
That didn't last long.
Better Deal versus Art of the Deal. Oh. Well, I don't know. I'm just. Better Deal for the people. Maybe if
how
you started
like
to connect the dots from of all of the slogans. Better Deal for the people.
Well, Michelle Obama
starts to get some rhyme. Yeah.
Michelle Obama is teaming up with some Hollywood A-listers. They're starting a group to get people out to vote for the midterm elections.
Get people to register.
Ready? Yeah. Well, guess what their group is called?
For the people.
No. Oh. When we all vote. When we all vote. It's a nonprofit. And she's going to meet with volunteers to make sure they get people out to vote.
When we all vote for the people, Better Deal. I think you've got, pieces there. If you put a little base to it, we could come up with.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey dot pro answer.
For the people, when we all vote. It's a better deal for the people when we all vote. Okay. What you say? I said it's a better deal for the people when we all vote.
Oh, see? You combined all three.
Yeah.
A better deal for the people when we all vote.
All right, let's keep adding to it. Tom in Deer Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. Neither party is a good choice for me. We've got the Democrat Party rapidly lurching left and now discussion openly of socialism. And then we've got a Republican Party who seems unable to check the president's authoritarian tendencies, mostly obsequiousness. There's some good policies, but they seem to be very chicken to keep President Trump's tendencies in check. And the reason for that is when they go back to the district, the voters are supporting the president and his antics. So I'm frightened.
Let me ask you this, Tom. You're in Deer Park. So who's your Congressman Hultgren?
No, Peter Roskam.
Oh, you're Roskam still. Okay. So Roskam and Hultgren are both in dead heats right now in their race. Hultgren, too. There's been some talk about Roskam, but Hultgren is also in a dead heat right now. Anyway, you have Roskam. So Roskam versus Kasten. You're talking about as much talk as there was about a Democrat takeover running through California. If we start losing suburban congressmen like Roskam and Hultgren, it could run through Illinois. So what's your choice going to be there, Roskam versus Kasten?
Oh, I support Roskam. Oh, we've supported him, and we'll be voting for him.
Okay.
He's a fine congressman, but I'm just talking overall for the system here, in the districts here. This is Trump land, he has authoritarian tendencies, and I don't see the Republicans keeping him in check. Yeah, we got some good policies, but. Oh. I don't feel good about it.
Well, okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Tom. I mean, it's not like he got a pass on his performance at that post-Putin presser on Monday. And it's not like that pressure didn't force him to make a restatement to backpedal on Tuesday, which he did. Mike in Bolingbrook.
All right, Dan, here you go. You and Amy, get your juices flowing with this one.
Okay.
A remix of Michael Jackson's We Are the World.
Mm-hmm.
Throw all that in there, and then I'd love to hear that puking. I'll hang up and go with it.
Oh, yeah, very, very good. Thanks for the call, Mike.
No, we are not. No.
It's a good reminder.
No, we're not doing that.
There it is.
Seriously, I'm not listening.
Well,
because it makes me nauseous.
That was a request from a listener.
Some people are eating breakfast right now and don't need to
hear
the music.
Not anymore. After that, Randy and Elkhorn.
Yeah, it's a better deal for all the people when we vote. Is that what it is?
It's a better deal for the people
when we all vote.
When we all vote. Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, when we all vote.
Yeah.
Twice.
When we all vote twice.
That's the winner. Winner, winner, chicken
Thanks,
dinner
Randy.
There.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, we're still workshopping this Dem midterm slogan. They just have For the People. We're trying to spice it up for them so, you know, they can make Jim Comey happy. So For the People. But then we have When We All Vote, Michelle Obama's Voter Reg initiative.
Yeah.
And then we have their
Better Deal was what it used to be.
Their previous one, yeah. So we got right now a better deal for the people when we all vote twice.
Okay.
All right. Let's see if we can continue our improvements there. John in Palatine.
Hey, Dan and Amy. How about free for all the people? Kind of like a free-for-all, like the Democratic Party is becoming.
Instead of For the People,
free-for-all the people. That's a kind of a double entendre. I like that. Thanks, John. Mike in Pleasant Prairie.
Yeah, hi, guys. I think in their typical Democratic stealth fashion, leaving part of it out, I think it's For the People, as is their need, from the people, as is their ability.
Oh, it's very, yes. Thank you, Comrade Mike. Yeah, very good. Appreciate it. I've heard that somewhere before. Paul in Plainfield.
Hey, Dan. So I heard a caller earlier ask about Donald Trump mentioning that Donald Trump was an authoritarian. My question is, what action has Donald Trump ever taken that would be considered authoritarian? I can't think of a single one.
Yeah, it's sort of rhetoric and tone. There's not a lot of policy decisions or executive actions that have been taken that would support that claim. I agree with you, Paul. Thanks for the call. Joe in Hoffman Estates.
I think a great slogan for the Democrats in the midterm would be, because Venezuela is not as bad as they make it out to be.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Joe.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And so the Putin meet maelstrom continues yesterday, the latest controversy that has whipped people into a frenzy, like Dick Blumenthal, who says, this is a United States senator. No, seriously. United States senator from Connecticut, Dick Blumenthal. So we have a 9/11 like crisis. The country's in a state of emergency. And the emergency continues amid calls by Democrats for hearings, whistle the translator in the meeting before Congress to disclose what he translated.
Right, during their private meeting. They want to subpoena him.
Suggestion that the conversation between Putin and Trump, this just that the entire meeting, this is Adam Schiff from the Democrat who represents Area 51, the entire meeting was part of the compromise.
Yeah, Michael Moore. I mean, his hair is always on fire, but he tweeted out,
covered by a hat.
Russians are holding him hostage by whatever they got on him,
yeah,
or whatever harm they are threatening to do to his family.
Yeah. I mean, he might as well be a Democrat member of Congress. There's a deep think piece on the Daily Beast about how the soccer ball Putin gave him
was what
could be bugged. How easy it would be to bug the soccer ball.
Well, are you kidding me?
Well, then I assume it's got if it's
a tiny ball.
If the soccer ball is bugged, I assume that the Russians then have great detail on what Barron is doing on a daily basis. But here's something else. The President of the United States gets something like that. Do you think our security people go over items that he gets to make sure that
they also check his food before every time he takes a bite?
But this is what we're talking about here. And so every utterance is going to be seen as evidence that he is, as I've been saying all week, Staff Sergeant Raymond Shaw. He is Russia's man in the Oval Office. He is being run by Putin. He is our Manchurian candidate. And so yesterday, at the close of a cabinet meeting where reporters were still peppering the president with questions, as they're wont to do, this happened.
Is Russia still targeting the U.S., Mr. President?
He said, thank you very much, no. Then somebody said, he said, thank you very much, go. Or was it no go? Or was it go no? Is it Yanni?
Laurel.
Play it back.
Ready?
Again.
We're going to play it in slow motion.
Slow down.
We got to
Zapruder this.
Got a dart in your neck.
Is Russia still targeting the U.S., Mr. President?
Let's go.
He clearly said Yanni.
He clearly said Laurel.
This has been taken as a suggestion that, again, Trump is doing the bidding of the Russians, saying that, no, they're not targeting us anymore.
I watched it. He said, thank you very much, no.
Right. And
Sarah Sanders meant, like, no more questions.
Right.
But to me, when he was answering the question from Holly Jackson from NBC, that's who was shouting the question, it looked to me like he said, no, they're not.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm not going to get my panties in a bunch over that, because who cares?
No, not that
one. Whatever.
But there is something.
I mean, nauseous. My head is spinning.
But there is something else that's problematic. I mean, he did this interview with Jeff Glor from CBS Evening News yesterday, CBS News. It was on the Evening News program. And, he restated his restatement from the day before, which was all well and good.
You say you agree with U.S. intelligence that Russia meddled in the election in 2016.
Yeah, and I've said that before, Jeff. I have said that numerous times before. And I would say that that is true, yeah.
But you haven't condemned Putin specifically. Do you hold him personally responsible?
Well, I would, because he's in charge of the country, just like I consider myself to be responsible for things that happen in this country. So certainly, as the leader of a country, you would have to hold him responsible, yes.
Okay, that's a sensible answer. And the president continued in describing what he told Putin about Russian interference in our elections at the meeting.
We're not going to have it. And that's the way it's going to be.
But he denies it. So if you believe U.S. intelligence agencies, is Putin lying to you?
I don't want to get into whether or not he's lying. I can only say that I do have confidence in our intelligence agencies as currently constituted. I think that Dan Coats is excellent. I think that Gina is excellent. I think we have excellent people in the agencies. And when they tell me something, it means a lot.
Okay. And then that builds on yesterday, where he also said, which he should have said at the press conference, we're taking steps, taking all necessary precautions, and I communicated as such about to make sure there is no effective effort to interfere with our elections in 2018 and beyond by the Russians or anybody else. Okay.
And Dan Coats yesterday said that there is still a threat with Russian interference.
I'm here to say the warning lights are blinking red again.
All right.
I would say on the matter.
Danger.
Pull over.
Dan Coats. Mike in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I've got a theory about the soccer ball. I think it's actually a leather-wrapped Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
It's got all sorts of surveillance gear inside of there, and they'll be inside the Oval Office for now on monitoring everything Trump does.
Yeah, you're probably right, Mike.
It did look like he was shaped oddly, because I've been around a lot of soccer ball. It didn't seem like a regular official size soccer ball.
Yeah.
Do you see the little antenna sticking out of it, too?
I think do you see that, what was the commercial for? But remember the commercial that featured like a Russian in a gilded room with like miniature giraffes? Oh. I forget the product now, but it was a Geico. It sounds like it would be a Geico commercial. But anyway, I think they could have miniaturized one of the spies, and that Russian spy is living inside the soccer ball.
I think they should give the soccer ball to the kids from the cave. The soccer team?
Oh,
too soon? Sorry. Gosh.
Glad you got out with love, Vlad. John in Cal Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. I saw a very interesting video montage yesterday of Obama, Biden, Hillary, and I think Pelosi was in the mix there, too, saying this was during when Romney was running against Obama. They're like, hey, what's your beef, man? The Cold War is over, basically. So now here we are today with, oh, my God, Russia's the bad guys now.
I know.
Yeah. Well, thanks
Whatever
for the call, John.
Narrative.
Yeah, they didn't...
I hated that moment from that election. Obama did that.
Well, and Trump has made this point a couple of times, as have others. Boy, President Obama and all of those deep thinkers and patriots around him heading up the intelligence agencies that are so vociferous now in criticism of Trump and Russia and so convinced of Russian not only interference, which I am convinced of as well, I mean, the evidence suggests, but also Russian collusion, of course, which there's no evidence to support by the president. Why didn't they take more steps, make this more public when they were in charge? Because they were in charge
right
through the duration of the 2016 election. So
yeah, people seem to forget that.
So what happened?
I reminded somebody yesterday. That was on President Obama's watch.
Yeah, what happened?
That happened.
So what? So maybe since they love the cable TV show so much, why don't you tell us, clap on, clap off, James Clapper, John Brennan, Michael Hayden, what did you guys do to deal with the Russia, the threat that Russia poses to our election and to our national security more generally? Give us chapter and verse. Love to hear from you. Jim in Tampa.
Good morning, guys. Dan, would you speculate on where this strategy of the Democrats is going, this hair on fire strategy? Where is this leading them?
With the strategy of what exactly are you characterizing as their strategy?
To compare things to 911 and
just
the whole crazy strategy that they all seem to be undertaking.
Yeah, this is a base plus exercise, right? This is a voter turnout, voter enthusiasm. So I think they believe, some of them must, that they need to, number one, feed the base, and that's where the energy is, the socialist base of the Democrat Party, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez segment, and turn them out. And I think they believe that... the hysteria and the P-hats and the Black Lives Matter and the identity politics on steroids is the way to generate the enthusiasm, to generate the turnout they need to regain control of Congress in November. That's what I think. I don't know. I mean,
that makes sense.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. I don't know what else they would be thinking. Now there's some Democrats that are suggesting that we should pump the brakes a little bit on some of the hysteria and some of the very public and open embrace of socialism, but not many. Joe in Indian Head Park.
Yes, I think that if he's Raymond Shaw, then Melania is his Queen of Hearts handler.
Yes.
She's from Slovenia, former satellite of the USSR. And I could just hear in her little accent, Donald, why don't you play a little solitaire?
Very good, Joe. Thank you for building on my Manchurian candidate. Appreciate it. Melania from Slovenia. Yeah. It's all starting to come into focus.
Did you see Melania, too, when she shook President Putin's hand? She was very nice. Then she turned around and she had this look of horror on her face. I don't know what that means. I'll show it to you.
He probably gave her the order. It's time to activate our asset.
She turned. I mean, I'll show it to you.
You know who I still believe is running the whole thing?
Barron.
Barron.
Yeah, Barron's he's got his whole floor on at the Trump Tower. I mean, I know he lives in the White House right now, but they go back and
forth. Like he's like Kaiser Sose. He doesn't even exist. I never see him.
You know what? You know what Eli said to me? Does he ever get older? Why is he always still a 10-year-old boy? Isn't he 12 now? And I'm like, you know what? And I looked it up. He is 12. Okay. They put him on the shelf that he's a 10-year-old. He has a 10-year-old son, and then yeah.
Those are different kids.
Those are trained actors.
Hollywood
extras?
They're like Saddam body doubles.
Oh.
It's just to create the appearance of a Barron.
He's tall. I hope he plays sports. Yeah, I hope they have a basketball in his hand.
Some of the Barrons are tall and others are not. George in Libertyville.
You know, Dan, you're absolutely right on your earlier comment.
About Barron?
Republicans, I think, had it. No. Yeah, he's a tall kid. You know, the only response the Republicans should have been given the whole time is maybe they did interfere. You guys were in charge. What did you do about it?
Yeah.
That would have been simply that would have squashed the whole thing. Is what maybe they did. You guys had absolute control. What did you do?
Thanks to the cultures. Maybe part of their strategy too is to make people forget to ask them and ask themselves the simple questions. I mean, that's the simplest of question. But yeah, let's hear from Clapper and the rest of them what they did. Be specific. And now with everything we know 2 years removed, boy, we could ask really specific follow-up questions to whatever they have to say. It's very much like Kim Strassel asking the perfect simple question after Peter Strzok's testimony last week. If you were being investigated by Peter Strzok and you knew that he had that kind of animus for you, would you feel like you were getting a fair shake? Exactly.
Real simple.
Greg in Milwaukee.
Hello.
Hey, Greg.
How are you? I have a perfect way to get out from this meddling thing for President Trump. When the press asks him, all he's got to do is answer the question by saying, of course they're not meddling anymore. President Obama told him to cut it out.
Thanks, Greg.
Opulence. I has it. I like the best, this one. But I also like savings the money. So when DirecTV tell me 5 months free for most premium television package, I jump in it.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, one thing that is troubling came out yesterday. Remember Putin during his press conference singled out this businessman named Bill Browder, who's exposed widespread Russian tax fraud that led to some sanctions against the Russia that Putin doesn't like. And he suggested that Browder had generated $400,000, made a $400,000 contribution illegally to the Hillary Clinton campaign. And that he had solid reason to believe some intelligence officers guided these transactions. So this was Putin's sort of response to, are you going to allow to be extradited the 12 who were indicted by Mueller?
Right.
And then he talks about, well, there we have this case, for example, and we have some interest, some people we would like to talk to. So, you know, a request will need to be made about the extradition if that's something the U.S. wants. And then we've got some of our requests as well. On Wednesday, Russian prosecutors communicated that they want to interview Mike McFaul, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Russia under Obama.
Yeah. And yesterday, they asked Sarah Sanders about that, you know, allowing Russians to interview and question American citizens. And she didn't. They said that they're still thinking about it.
Russian authorities yesterday named several Americans who they want to question, who they claim were involved in Bill Burr's quote-unquote crimes in their terms, including a former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. Does President Trump support that idea? Is he open to having U.S. officials questioned by Russia?
The president's going to meet with his team, and we'll let you know when we have an announcement on that.
For a second, is that a topic that came up in their conversation? Did President Putin raise this with President Trump?
There was some conversation about it, but there wasn't a commitment made on behalf of the United States, and the president will work with his team, and we'll let you know if there's an announcement on that front.
I mean, that would be unprecedented if we allowed them to question our American citizens.
Well, also, State Department spokesman Heather Nauert called the request to interview McFaul absolutely absurd.
Oh.
Which it is absolutely
absurd. It is absurd. Well, why aren't these two ladies on the same page?
I don't know. But that's a problem. There is no way.
No way.
The idea of compelling any American to be questioned by Russian investigators, much less the idea that we would start doing some kind of you allow us to extradite the 12 who were indicted and we'll, you know, send over some people that you want to talk to.
Uh-uh.
Absolutely fracking not. Are you nuts? It's crazy. No way. There's no way we would ever, or should at least ever, compel such an occurrence. It's absurd.
Hey.
And it should have been dismissed out of hand. Should have been dismissed out of hand. Spence in LaPorte, Indiana.
Guys, I think what cracks me up about this, and I am surprised I don't hear this more often from conservatives and from TV media, is the fact that the Democrats call Trump out for being buddies with Putin, but yet inside the realm of their own party, they've got known and very open socialist/communists actually running for office. Yet that's not a problem in our country, but a guy that lives in his country that's running his communist country, they have a problem with. I'm shocked by that.
Their newfound concern for Russia. Yeah, there's no question. Thanks for the call, Spence. Pete in Montgomery.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. My whole problem with this entire scenario is that the Democrats seem to be conflating two separate issues, vote tampering and propaganda. We should definitely oppose and strongly oppose vote tampering, but propaganda is propaganda. There's no way you're going to be able to prevent that from happening. So you fight against that with the truth, and that's not happening. And everything that the Democrats are saying simply bolsters the propaganda war that the Russian Federation is perpetrating right now.
Thanks for the call, Pete.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5, on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on to something when she calls capitalism into question?
312-642-5600 is our turnkey Depro answer line.
I don't mean from her perspective, I don't mean embracing socialism, but some skepticism of capitalism as our value system. Our economic system is one thing. Our value system can be something else. A piece in First Things by Matthew Schmitz, Cultural Realpolitik. In it, he discusses woke capital versus the working class. Woke capital versus the working class. When the Supreme Court took up the Obergefell case, this is, of course, the redefinition of marriage case, 379 businesses, including McKinsey, Bain, Goldman Sachs, Google, Morgan Stanley, submitted amicus briefs. They argued allowing same-sex couples to marry improves employee morale and productivity, which contributes significant returns for our shareholders and owners. There's money to be made in gay rights. Large global firms, especially supportive of the LGBT cause, references a book from a professor at Williams College. 2010, 75% of the 1,000 largest firms in the United States mandated quote unquote non-discrimination for sexual orientation. Among the Fortune 500, it was 89%.
Oh yeah, I've been inside a Fortune 500 company where they have bathrooms and they have transgender bathrooms. Showers and come on in.
Woke capital.
Why don't they just have one large bathroom and put us all together?
Woke capital. And Schmitz makes the point, corporations set the standard on LGBT rights, then they impose the standard on others. Indiana, Arizona, Georgia moved to implement religious freedom bills. It was big corporations that threatened a capital strike. As Delta put it, such laws, religious freedom laws, mm-hmm. as were upheld, religious freedom, I should say, not necessarily the laws, religious freedom upheld by the Supreme Court, most recently in that Masterpiece Cake Shop case. This is what was happening at the state and local level in response to the Obergefell decision to make sure that religious freedom was not unconstitutionally impinged upon. But when Indiana, Georgia, Arizona moved in that direction, Delta said such laws were inconsistent with the ethic of a, quote, global values-based company. It's interesting because he opens his piece before he gets to corporations talking about the floats in the 2017 New York Pride Parade. On a clear day in June 2017, 2 million people lined the route of the New York Pride Parade to cheer as floats sponsored by Deutsche Telekom, Nissan, Facebook, Toronto Dominion Bank went by. Marchers wearing resistance T-shirts led the way, followed by the ranks of New York's finest marching, before a corrections department van painted rainbow colors. Trojan brand ambassadors threw condoms to the crowd like candy, even with children stretching out their hands. All seemed to be well until 12 members of a group called No Justice, No Pride blockaded the parade in front of the Stonewall Inn, the Lexington and Concord of gay liberation, as Matthew Schmitz puts it. They denounced the parade for having become the world's longest Super Bowl commercial break, glorifying an economic system they say is inimical, to LGBT rights. And then the protesters were hustled out.
So they weren't protesting gays. They were protesting the companies that benefit off of
the commercialization of gay rights. Okay. The commercialization of gay rights, which these leftist gay activists found to be not consistent with their, you know, socialist worldview, the same way you would get that reaction from Occupy Wall Streeters or members of Congress from the Bronx these days. The unwillingness of the right to criticize corporations is relatively new. Until World War II, conservative thinkers, writes Schmitz, like Southern agrarians, sometime conservative politicians before he went full bull moose, like Teddy Roosevelt, mounted vigorous critiques of unfettered capital and viewed corporations as political agents that needed to be called to account. Policies that corporations promote are the bourgeois virtues. And they also promote a less traditional set of values. The main beneficiary of the economic policies championed by conservatives, argues Schmitz, has been a managerial class that prefers sexual liberation to the austerities of the Protestant ethic. The class is more secular, more progressive, and more privileged than the rest of America. Its members have enjoyed growing incomes as the incomes of working-class Americans have stagnated. They have benefited from globalization and supported free trade, this managerial class. Pride parades are the festivals of this class's faith. They present global corporations as the breakers of boundaries. Right? This is a particularly poignant example. A spokeswoman for the United Nations Human Rights Office defended the manufacture of gay pride apparel in overseas sweatshops when worlds collide.
Oh.
She said, making pride T-shirts in a place where homosexuality is illegal could be considered a way of making inroads towards more human rights. Schmitz writes, free trade meets free love. Mm. And there are populists that have challenged this faith, Bernie Sanders even. Koch brothers' proposal, which is essentially there's no United States. That was Sanders criticizing the Koch brothers from a sort of America First perspective. These are the culture war's true battle lines, concludes Schmitz. On one side are well-scrubbed members of the managerial class who believe that any constraint on the free movement of labor, goods, and capital is a violation of global values. They're fully committed to the central project of neoliberalism, the insulation of markets from democratic pressure, small d. They also wish to protect desire from any legal, cultural, or moral restraint. On the other side are the unwashed people of varying political stripes who intuit that economic life should be subject to political authority, which today rests in the nation. They believe in moral norms and national boundaries. Christians need to practice cultural realpolitik. No explanation of the meaning of marriage, however rigorously argued or scrupulously secular, can overcome the power of a managerial elite that is wholly opposed to the kind of society for which Christians hope. Refusal to see this has been fatal to the traditionalist cause. While arguing against liberal social changes, they've cheered economic policies that harm their natural allies and aid their opponents. They've handed a shovel to their own gravedigger. Progressives now stand with global capital, as the Pride Parade so clearly shows. Christians, in turn, should stand with the working class, which is more religious, more diverse, and more patriotic than the managerial elite. Only by reducing inequality and restraining corporations can Christians avoid being buried. Only by challenging the ideology of free markets and open borders can they advance their view of the common good. The struggle between woke capital and the working class will determine the outcome of the culture war. 312-642-5600, Turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, Turnkey.pro text line. Do you agree? Is that what Christians need to do? Oppose the managerial elite, the kind of secular corporate class, remind those that our economic life is subject to a political authority? Is that the way to win the culture war? Or to win the culture war really just means to have policies that are reflective of your and the and Christian moral views? Mike, on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So this has been a problem for me from the beginning. So I'm a gay conservative, and we constantly are used as a yo-yo game to play identity politics.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, and the left wants to do that, then at some point, if the gay life and people from of color and all these other groups that come together have to have our rights beat over everybody's head, then why is it so difficult for people who are traditionalists, people who are Christians, which I am a Christian, don't they get the same rights? Why do we always defer to the people who are squawking the loudest and just make the biggest stink? We want to spend the rest of our life being treated as equal, but we do everything in our power to separate ourselves from the norm. So you can't have it both ways.
Well, it's an interesting point you raise, Michael. One of the things, too, I think it's Matthew Schmitz. I don't agree with everything in here, but I think he makes some important points. And one of the things is that big corporate interests that are secular and progressive, woke capital, as he calls them, you know what they're really interested in? They're not interested in gays or Christians or gay Christians or this conversation at all. You know what they're interested in? Stability. They want you to be docile. They want you to be docile. They want us all to be docile. They want to buy you off and shut you up so there is stability. And this is a point I think that Schmitz is making that I do agree with, that capitalism is not a religion. It's an economic system. And
100%, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that 100%.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Appreciate it.
The
other Mike. We had Michael from the north side. This is Mike from the north side.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks.
You know, you can't explain to these stupid liberals, so I'll just try to give you an example. Once a month at my church, they take a collection up. You bring toiletries and food and products for poor families. You load it in a truck. One person drives it over and delivers it. If it was a government program, there'd be 18 people. There would be people talking to the press. There would be superintendents. There would be inspectors. And half the stuff would disappear. It would never go to the poor people. Even President Kennedy, the liberals' great lion, said, if you want to help a poor person, give it to the church. Give it to your church. Give it to any church. Just don't give it to the government.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate it. I mean, that's right. There's the Beatitudes are all about private action, not tithing to the state. Greg in Schaumburg.
I think the immigration issue is really directly related to this when these people were advocating that there are no borders anymore. And that's kind of related to the theory that there's a world law that is above and beyond our U.S. Constitution. It's kind of all rolled into one.
Okay. I mean, I think there's something to that, particularly the populist critique of globalization. That generated so much enthusiasm for Trump. I mean, Trump is at his core a populist, and I think what Schmitz is pointing to has sort of has populist appeal across party lines, because it's really class, and not that we have classes in this country, but it's socioeconomic and it's cultural, and there is a real divide. And I think the idea that the divide is between sort of the managerial set, generally speaking, versus blue-collar working Americans versus people who take their faith seriously. I think that is a divide. And it's not easily bridged.
I do too, Dan, but what I was just saying is that I think it's showing up on many, many fronts, as the Linsky stuff always does, in order to get a middle where they want it to be moved.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Thanks for the call, Greg.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The question is this: are we seeing the limits this week of Trump's decision first, details later, art of the deal approach to politics? Are we seeing the limits of it? Or, from the press conference forward, is President Trump purposely triggering leftist hysteria that we've seen? The leftist hysteria, the Russian Manchurian candidate conspiracy theories, the soccer ball with the listening devices, and all the other conjecture from the left. Conjecture is polite. Is he intentionally triggering that to his political and policy advantage? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line, while also restating his commitment to his own very good foreign policy team, as he did again yesterday in a sit-down with Jeff Glover from CBS.
You say you agree with U.S. intelligence that Russia meddled in the election in 2016.
Yeah, and I've said that before, Jeff. I have said that numerous times before. And I would say that that is true, yeah.
But you haven't condemned Putin specifically. Do you hold him personally responsible?
Well, I would, because he's in charge of the country, just like I consider myself to be responsible for things that happen in this country. So certainly, as the leader of a country, you would have to hold him responsible, yes.
And you know the kind of reaction it's getting. I mean, when I said comparisons to 9/11, I'm not kidding. Listen to Richard Blumenthal, Dick Blumenthal from Connecticut.
So what are you going to do about this? You brought up the translator. Do you think Republicans will actually allow a subpoena to be issued to get the translator to testify before Congress to say what went on behind closed doors?
Well, that is a key question, John. And my answer is that Republicans have a historic responsibility, as do all of us, because the red light is flashing, as the director of national security, Dan Coats, put it, much as it was before 9/11. We are in a 9/11 national emergency.
Oh, my God.
And not only that, not only is the red light flashing, more importantly, most importantly, Jim Comey is watching us.
Oh, he
Jim
is.
Jim Comey is watching us right now.
History is watching us.
And
is history your friend, Dan?
All who believe in this country's values must vote for Democrats this fall. Otherwise, you're a godless communist, like our next guest, Mike Gallagher. He is the host of the Mike Gallagher Show, of course, that follows us weekdays 9 to 11 on these airwaves. Mike Gallagher, please don't tell us you're going to disappoint Jim Comey.
Listen, I haven't been able to sleep since I saw his tweets because I'm very concerned. I thought if anybody needs a voice in this, it's Jim Comey. The book tour, you know, he's over to Kmart over in Piqua, Ohio, and he's selling some books. And he decided, you know, the sales are a little down. Let me get back into the spotlight. Let me inject myself into this. I mean, honest to goodness, guys, can you really picture a former FBI director acting like a field office director for the Democrat Party of you know of the East Wing or something? I mean, it's the craziest thing. From Brennan and his unhinged rantings to Comey and Clapper, you know, what a shock that Trump stood in Russia and is a little bit wary of his own intelligence community, because there are still plenty of holdovers from the Obama era who are in the intelligence community, and this is a president who doesn't forget. So, you know, I can't imagine anybody really, this is the typical feigned outrage from the media. Oh my gosh, he doesn't really have a lot of faith in the intelligence community. Now, having said that, he gets back, he sees the blowback, he tells Jeff Glore from CBS, I sat down with Putin, I was very strong, I told him no meddling, you know, we're not going to tolerate meddling, I know he was meddling, but they don't believe him. They're not going to, I mean, I you hear all these analogies, if he learned how to walk on water, they'd say it's because he doesn't know how to swim. I mean, there's never going to get any, he's never going to receive any credit from the howler monkeys in the mainstream press, and even some Republicans who hate the guy with such a passion that they abandon their own conservative principles just so they can try to tear him down. Here's a little ditty. Here's a little tiny little a little factoid that never Trump Republicans might want to consider. This week, the Senate Republicans have broken the all-time record on presidential picks for the appeals court judges. They voted Senators 50-49 vote Andrew Oldham. He's going to be a judge on the Fifth Circuit. That makes him Trump's 23rd Circuit Court judge confirmed. That's a record. It's the most ever in the first 2 years of a presidency, which, of course, as we all know, will shape the direction of the U.S. court system for decades. Now, maybe we ought to get more excitable about whether he said no or would or wouldn't or shoulda or tomato or tomato. But I kind of like the makeup of the courts. I kind of like the way the Supreme Court is going to continue to look. And incidentally, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg or maybe even Clarence Thomas step down and you start seeing...
Clarence Thomas?
That's the buzz
on you. How dare you?
I know. Well, God forbid. But
I refuse to entertain that.
I'm hearing that. No, I hate it. I hate to even get those words out in the universe, but that's been some buzz for a few weeks now that he's considering it. But I mean, just think of the of what this Supreme Court is going to look like with even two more years, or hopefully six more years of a Republican president. So, you know, it's just another day in paradise for these guys. They're not going to believe him anyway. Watching these crazy reporters in the press briefing yesterday, screeching out of turn, April Ryan trying to, once and for all, will somebody tell me why the White House feels obligated to give the people who are going to misbehave in that White House press briefing a credential? Yet not everybody gets to walk in off the street and sit in that small room and ask questions. Get somebody else from American Urban Network if this is going to turn into the April Ryan show every afternoon.
Well, what did she – I didn't see the whole thing. What did she do that was so upsetting?
So Sarah Sanders is calling on different people, and, you know, as is her wont, she calls on who she wants to. Well, April's sitting over there seething and starts screeching out something about voter disenfranchisement. Wasn't even anything that they were talking about. And you're not going to call on me, so I'm going to call on you. Starts bellowing at her. Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah. They're great foils.
It's great TV. I mean, it's must-see TV, and it's fun to watch and listen to on the radio. And it's, you know, and Sarah Sanders, holy cow, what job won't she be able to do after she leaves the White House?
Yeah. Well, I wonder what restaurants she could eat at. Like,
well,
I mean, come
yeah,
on.
Right.
Yeah, I know. There's one restaurant that I don't think they're going to have an opening for, but she's a tough cookie, and it's interesting to watch the left react to her too. They loathe her too. I mean, they just hate her. They just think she is, you know, the devil personified. And there's just a lot of anger and a lot of hate on our side. We just have to try to be consistent and unified and recognize things that matter, as the late Charles Krauthammer would say.
Well, let's go to things that matter then. And I kind of started the segment. I want to get to your response to the question I posed, because Daniel Henninger has an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal about this. This is the art of the deal, question mark. And he essentially argues that, well, I'll recite his words here, past some point of complexity, such as the global supply chain or North Korea's nuclear program, decision first and strategy later degrades into deadlock or what may be worse, happy talk, which in times erodes credibility. Are we seeing the limits of Trump's approach in the international arena on trade, on North Korea, on Russia? Or, as Angelo Codavia argues in American at amgreatness.com, Codavia, of course, who coined the term ruling class that has become popularized, said basically that Trump's performance at that press conference was A+, and the journalist who asked him that question that he had to restate his answer to the day after was out of bounds. Where are we?
I'm not sure the question was out of bounds, but I do know we've seen a president whose actions often don't line up with his words. In other words, he says something at a press event. I kind of believe he's the ultimate troll. Either on Twitter or even at press events. You know,
the ultimate troll.
The ultimate. He's just trying to get under their skin, and it works. I mean, I think he sits back. Listen, I've been with him a few times since he became president, and I sit in a room with him. Guys, he doesn't have a care in the world. He doesn't give two hoots about upsetting CNN. He just doesn't.
Sure. It's no, the I believe strange, that.
I mean, because if it was you, any of us, well, you guys are pretty tough. But in my case, I wouldn't be able to get out of bed because I'd think, man, how much more can I take? He thrives on this. So it doesn't seem to impact him on a personal level. I think he's got a game going where when he's one-on-one with reporters, he says things, and then the actions often don't meet the rhetoric. And we're seeing that with North Korea. There were mixed messages about what was going to happen with North Korea. It's a verifiable fact that we've been a lot tougher on Russia than the previous administration was. Everybody knows that.
I mean, we haven't lightened up on sanctions. You know, there's a whole list of things that President Trump has not done.
Sarah read that list yesterday, and it's even longer than the list we all typically refer to. So, and much more significant than Barack Obama's list. So, you know, this guy just is a showman. He gets up on stage, even when he's standing next to Putin. He knows the world is watching, and he's going to say things.
And Jim Comey.
Yeah.
Jim Comey's watching too.
Yeah, Jim Comey, and he may tweet. I mean, I'm worried about. I just am praying. I've got my eye glued on his Twitter feed to see if he says something that tells me what I should do next week. He says he's going to tell me how to vote in November so I can be a patriot. This really highly regarded. He wasn't disgraced or fired or anything. I mean, he really has a lot. He has a lot to say. And Brennan, this poor guy.
Very thoughtful. A thoughtful, measured individual.
Yeah, not too over the top. You know,
he's so
and honestly,
I call him madman. I mean, but, it looks like he's angry all
but
the time.
But Dan and Amy, that's what I wonder so much about, and I can say this even about some of our dear friends close to home. I get that you can say I don't like what the president, his press conference in Helsinki. I get it. You could say, okay, I wish he'd have said this. And there were a lot of moments during the campaign where I said, I wish he would have worded it this way. But to go from preferring he used better language or a better answer to he's a traitor and he's guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, never support him again. I don't know how you make that leap. I honest to goodness, I don't. It's that personality nature. It's just very personal for some of these folks.
Well, yeah, Mike, let you're a sporting fellow. I know this.
Yes,
and
sir.
We want to give Democrats a chance in November. We want this to be fun. We want them to be able to participate and put their best foot forward. So we've been working all morning, and maybe you can help us out a little bit.
Oh, with their new slogan.
Yeah, they unveiled, House Democrats unveiled their slogan for the midterms, and it's an upgrade from their previous one, which was Better Deal. Now their slogan is For the People.
For the People?
Yeah.
Michelle Obama has a new
Voter
registration initiative with Tom Hanks and Faith Hill.
Yeah.
And that is...
When we all vote.
I like that. We
got Better Deal for the People when we all vote. If you kind of combine this ransom note, you can kind of
And in Chicago, thanks to your alderman, Maya Pawar, you have free money for all. I love universal basic income. I mean, that's a real winning formula.
He's my alderman.
free money for all.
I think you got it. I think you just hit it for the slogan, free money for all. That's
free
the
money
slogan.
For all. Although it's not really free money for all because we're the ones that are going to have to pay, but somebody's going to get $500 a month to buy on liquor and strip clubs, and whatever else they want to spend their money on. Because after all, that's the Democratic Party of 2018. Honest to goodness, the face of the Democrats of 2018, this is right up their alley. When I read that this guy got all kinds of backing from Chicago politicians to provide 1,000 families with a $500 monthly stipend, no questions asked. There it is. Free money. Just free money. This is a vote for a Democrat. You get $500 maybe.
Free money.
Free money
as the 2018 slogan. I like that.
It's like the Price is Right. It's like the Price is Right, Chicago style.
It's succinct. It's substantive.
Yeah,
it's reflective of their philosophy. That covers a lot of bases.
Entitlement. You got the entitlement box checked. I mean, this is they're onto something there. We need to just do that. Just start writing money. Just writing checks.
Just send me money. In
you should. Shoot that over to Tom Perez and have you guys workshop that.
The only problem is we're laughing and we're joking, but you know what? I guarantee you there's a whole bunch of them, as you've seen this Democrat socialist 28-year-old in New York who, you know, this poor girl, I mean, don't ask her about Israel. Please don't ask her about capitalism, because what a bizarro world answer. But she's going to win. She's going to be the congresswoman from the Bronx in New York.
I think we should actually amend the Constitution so that because she won't be 35 in 2020, so she can run for president.
Listen, if she can give free money for all, I'm in, because I could use the $500. You know, I've got some trips planned. I want to do some stuff. I want to, you know, I got to get some more clothes. I'm ready. I'm in. Voting for Ocasio.
He is Mike Gallagher. He's coined the 2018 midterm slogan, and he'll have more of his rhetorical stylings at 9 a.m. today. Mike Gallagher, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dan and Amy. Keep it up. Keep fighting the good fight.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Get your free tickets to meet Sean Spicer in Chicago on August 8th. Go to 560theanswer.com/briefing.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And, you know, these TED Talks are quite popular, right? Introduced us to a lot of interesting intellects over the years. And then sometimes you get somebody like this University of Würzburg medical student, Miriam Haney?
Yeah. I'm the name assassinator.
I don't know.
Wait, let me see. I'll assassinate.
H-E-I-N-E.
H-E-I-N-E?
Yeah.
Heine. Like your buttocks.
Okay. Well, this young woman began her...
With the tiny hiney?
Talk of pedophilia.
Oh, come on.
What do you mean? This was a talk.
Okay.
You don't think this is cultural relevance? Right, no, on. This is never going to... we're never going to mainline, try to mainstream, normalize pedophilia, right?
We can't do that. We're not doing that, right, Dan?
Mm-hmm.
I've met pedophilias.
She starts out with, as all sentimentalists do, with the... anecdote, the tragic case of a young man named Jonas.
Let me tell you about Jonas. Jonas is 19 years old. He studies law in Munich. In his spare time, he likes to play soccer. Jonas has a secret which he thinks he cannot share with anyone, not even with his best friend, or with his parents. He's just too afraid of anger, rejection, and repulsion. Jonas knows that he has to suppress his sexual drive for his entire life. And he also knows that there will never be a loving and fulfilling partnership that he can enter. Because Jonas is a pedophile.
Oh, my God.
He's only attracted to female children between the ages of 6 and 12 years.
And
so he likes his girls prepubescent. This Jonah, why is she talking like this?
Well, that's her accent.
I know, but she's very, the cadence is very.
Yes.
Pick it up, sweetheart. Jeez.
She also had this rather jarring statement about pedophilia, as she, I guess the purpose was to give us a bigger, deeper, better understanding of pedophilia. She suggests that, of course, 99% of pedophiles are men, and that represents between 1% and 2% of the global male population, so that's about 16 million people, bigger than the, more populous than the countries of, say, Italy or South Africa.
How many people?
16 million globally. So it's not something you can ignore, and she's right about that. It's not something that should be ignored. That's why we have
something that should be incarcerated.
Incarceration, sex offender laws, and the like. But if it seems to me she wants to treat this as sort of a public health problem in the same way that guns are treated as a public health problem, she wants to suggest that this is an orientation, and so you're sort of beholden to this orientation, and one wonders if that would inhibit people from seeking or being forced, as the case may be, in the case of illegal conduct, forced into the kind of psychological help that they need to address this predatory instinct. Here's what this young woman had to say about pedophilia.
According to current research, pedophilia is an unchangeable sexual orientation, just like, for example, heterosexuality.
Oh.
No one chooses to be a pedophile. No one can cease being one. The difference between pedophilia and other sexual orientations is that living out this sexual orientation will end in a disaster.
Yeah, and
you cannot compare heterosexuality to being a pedophile.
She goes on to talk about this, as I said, sort of as a societal problem. She suggests that social isolation is one of the reasons that pedophiles act on instincts that they're trying to control, and that isolation also makes them fearful to express their inclination. So this, again, is sort of bring them into the fold. We shouldn't increase the sufferings of pedophiles by excluding them, by blaming and mocking them. Just like pedophiles, we're not responsible for our feelings. We do not choose them, but it is our responsibility to overcome our negative feelings about pedophiles and to treat them with the same respect we treat other people.
No, we shouldn't. Because if you had a daughter, is it one of your imaginary hypothetical children a girl? Oh, no, you have two boys.
I have two boys, but I'm not sure I'm done having kids.
Yeah. Oh, so you're leaving the door open?
The door's open.
So what if you had a daughter? And you think that you're comparing what they have is the same thing to being a heterosexual? And that we should accept their bad behavior?
You understand the poison of sentimentality? Which is the basis of all left politics. That's what this is another manifestation of. You don't understand you collectively, people don't understand the deep, dark places this sentimental barbarism takes you. It takes you to statements like, just like pedophiles, we are not responsible for our feelings. We do not choose them. But it's our responsibility to overcome our negative feelings about pedophiles.
I have a negative feeling about pedophiles because they break the law and they take advantage of the young and the innocent.
Well, she of course would say, well, of course I covered that by saying that if it's only acting on it, but if they act on it, then that's a disaster and child sexual abuse is never okay. Well, let me tell you something. I mean, we've talked about it on the show over the last couple of years. There have been pieces in left magazines like Slate trying to mainstream pedophilia because love is love, right?
Isn't that what Mark Kirk say? We should love.
Life is all about who you love and who loves you back. And that's the only standard. Is it? Because that's where this standard brings you. I mean, you know, you think, oh, this is crazy and this is salacious and prof's being hysterical. Really? Last year, 2 years ago, did you think you'd see this story? Planet Fitness bans woman for refusing to share a locker room with transgender man. Do you think you'd hear that story? I don't think so. I mean, this is how fast it happens when you indulge the sentimental barbarians. I've said this before on the issue of marriage redefinition. Try to find a reference to gay marriage before 1995. Go ahead, check your little internet box there. Before 95. It was virtually non-existent. And 20 years later, it's not only the law of the land, it's mandatory celebration. And then it's on to the next thing. Your gender is whatever you say it is at any given moment, and so is your race, and so is every other identifying characteristic, and then intersectionality, and then something that is truly ghastly, predatory, unbelievably damaging. At the same time, we look at these scandals in the Catholic Church or the Chicago public school system or Michigan State, all those gymnasts that were profiled on the ESPYs last night.
Yeah, they received the Arthur Ashe Courage Award.
Right, so
hundreds of them were on stage.
So we're aghast at this, where we all kind of share the same moral indignation and outrage and incredulity. Penn State, but you have this insidious pseudo intellectual class promulgating this poison. And we don't see it. We don't pay no attention. We think it's, marginal, quackery. It's not. Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. First, a question. Is she advocating acceptance, or is she merely making the statement that pedophiles don't change their behavior over time, period?
You know, she sort of soft pedals it. I mean, she's suggesting that the orientation is unchangeable, but it's all of our problem, and we need to be a more accepting, tolerant, respectful society so that they get the help they need, and so on and so forth.
Right, right. I mean, she could have stopped the statement right there, because it is true that pedophiles have one of the highest recidivism
rates of doing
anything. And unfortunately, like many of us, we don't talk about this, but I mean, I have a best friend from college whose wife was violated from a very early age. She didn't find this out until after they were married. You can imagine that caused some problems. They're still together. It was her father. And, unfortunately, also, I actually played a role in defending somebody from a pedophile's opportunistic attacks. And that was something that I thought that it was going to drive somebody in my family to bring arms up and go take care of that pedophile.
Yeah,
there's a pederast that lives down the street from me.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
I know, because I did a sexual offender thing. And what are you going to do except watch them?
Well, but here's the thing. When you start saying things like it's a natural condition, it's an unchangeable orientation.
It's a perversion.
She made it sound like he's the victim, she's doing. Like, we should have sympathy for him. Because look at this poor guy. He's living a life of secrets he can't tell his friends or his parents.
Well,
gross.
Right, that's the sentimentality of it. But it's the idea of essentially characterizing it as a natural condition. The next step is to say it's natural, it's unchangeable, it's acceptable. The next change is to mainstream NAMBLA. I mean, it really is.
Right, and I would argue that when she starts going down that sentimentality road, there's a different reason why he can't share this information with other people. Number one, because deep down he knows it's wrong. And number two, he'll be prosecuted for it. It's more of a preservation, a survival instinct that he is, in fact, feeding not the suppressing of the desire. I would say unless this is just completely made up and she's got this, you know, straw man person she's putting together, that guy will end up doing something for which he should be prosecuted.
Thank
because
well,
yeah.
until
he fixes that, he's going to be a problem.
Thanks
I think
for the call,
that
Ralph.
She's arguing that being a pedophile is not a crime. That
no.
it should be an accepted condition and
yes.
not a prosecutable condition.
Well, it's not prosecutable unless you act on it. But she's doing more than that. She's walking down this path to normalization, as I'm suggesting. Dave in Itasca.
Jonah is a pervert.
Okay, thanks for the call, Dave.
What was that?
That was him doing
talking like this.
Yeah, his impersonation
Thank
of her.
Thank you very much.
Sean in Elmwood Park.
Hi, Sean.
First off, as a father
Hi,
of girls, this how are you? This offends me on many, many levels. But what does it cost average to send a kid to college? $30,000, $26,000, and this is the dimwit that is influencing my kid? Did you listen to the buffoon? Now, here's the thing, she touches on a nugget. She's exactly right. The recidivism rate is almost 100%. But why does the left, why do these socialists hate children? Whether it's normalizing the murder and the dismemberment of them in abortion, or it's normalizing the sexual abuse, why do they hate the kids? And here's the beauty of growing up in Melrose Park. We didn't have pedophiles. We had missing people, because that's what people do. You touch the kid, you don't call. I don't call the police. I think someone is touching my kid.
Yeah.
You call the police on me to dust the crucifix in the forest, because that's what it's going to take.
Okay.
Everybody wants to
yeah.
turn to a magic man.
Yeah.
Help me, save me.
Okay.
I'm not kidding you.
Okay.
I got a creep
okay.
right now. Okay,
vigilante justice. Just remember how it turned out in Mystic River. You know, you make sure you get the right guy. Thanks for the call,
yeah.
Sean.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So President Trump continues to deal with the fallout from his post-Putin presser and the hysteria on the left, the call for hearings and whistling in the translator to tell us everything that all of the national secrets Trump so clearly must have conveyed to his Russian operator Putin during their sit-down. Trump talking to CBS News, Jeff Glor, yesterday, and here's what he said to Glor that he said to Putin about interfering with our elections.
We're not going to have it, and that's the way it's going to be.
But he denies it, so if you believe U.S. intelligence agencies, is Putin lying to you?
I don't want to get into whether or not he's lying. I can only say that I do have confidence in our intelligence agencies as currently constituted. I think that Dan Coats is excellent. I think that Gina is excellent. I think we have excellent people in the agencies. And when they tell me something, it means a lot.
That's something that one wishes the president would have said in the moment at that press conference. But that's more of his backpedaling. But the real question, Amy, of course, is
what?
That soccer ball.
Yeah. What's in the soccer ball? Huh?
What's in the ball?
What's in the soccer ball? Soccer ball. What is in that soccer ball that Putin gave
that
Trump?
There might be a taping or some kind of recording device inside that soccer ball.
Daily.
Don't kick it too hard.
The Daily Beast went into some detail about how a listening device could easily be embedded in the stitching of the soccer ball.
And I suggested that they give that soccer ball to the kids in Thailand who just got out of the cave. That would be a nice gesture.
Yeah.
Kick this around, kids.
Hmm? Okay. here's the
Did
thing.
Did I just wink at you?
Here, if Trump is Putin's Manchurian candidate, if he's Staff Sergeant Raymond Shaw, then why would you need to embed a listening device in a soccer ball? You already have him. You've already flipped President Trump. Why would you need the soccer ball? You see what I'm saying? Yeah. You see how the plot doesn't hold
Maybe
up?
Maybe he just took it from the World Cup game.
I think the
France beat Croatia 4-2.
I think the Democrats need better spy novelists writing their stuff, is my point. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Cortez, CNN political commentator and former Trump Hispanic Advisory Council boss. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So are you concerned about Putin operating Trump, having a man in the Oval Office, and should there be hearings and ultimately, obviously, a trial for treason?
Right. Well, you know, if you listen to mainstream media, you would think that Trump gave Alaska back to Russia the other day with Putin. But look, I said this last night on CNN, and I really believe it. I think that this whole Trump is compromised slash Russian agent, you know, slash Manchurian candidate, this whole theme of that he is beholden to Russia somehow has become the birtherism of the left. And I really believe that. And it's just as silly. It's just as loony. Rather than talk about here are the reasons this man that we don't trust got elected and here's why we lost. The right did this. The Alex Jones of the world did this during President Obama's era. Instead of focusing on his policies and why he was in a policy sense incorrect, they tried to delegitimize his candidacy and his legitimacy as president by saying he wasn't born here. That was just silliness and lunacy. We right. see now the same thing on the left with this Russia theme.
So you're saying that
they still haven't gotten over 2016, they have to concoct and make up a reason why he wasn't legitimate in the first place, and he didn't really win. It was only because of this Russian interference that he won.
So do you think that President Trump was born in Kenya? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Is that what I'm hearing?
No, and listen, I'll be the first to obviously admit President Trump went down that road as that private citizen Trump, a birther, and that was nonsense. He did disavow it during the campaign. It was good that he did. So you can come back from this. He became the president of the United States. I would advise the left, let go of this absolute Russian fairy tale. You lost the election because you lost blue collar workers in the Midwest. That's the reality, not because of the Russians. Moscow, Idaho matters a lot more to most Americans than Moscow, Russia.
Yeah, but do you think that President Trump was kissing his butt a little too much? I mean, Putin seemed to control everything. He was an hour late,
right.
Which I thought was a sign of disrespect. But I don't know. During that press conference, he brought the bug soccer ball. Yeah, I don't know. I just had an uncomfortable feeling watching it.
I wrote about this on Real Clear Politics. I don't always defend the president, even though I'm a staunch advocate of his in general. I thought he was far too deferential. I thought it was one of the only times him not command the scene. It looked to me just, and a lot of this is just optics and style, not so much substance, but still that matters. It didn't seem like he was in charge, and I thought he was way too deferential to President Putin. I'll be the first to say that. Now, you know, in his defense, it was the end of a very arduous week in Europe, most of which was highly contentious. So, you know, I think we have to sort of give him a pass. If, you know, he earned a mulligan on having perhaps an off day. But it was an off day, in my opinion.
Well,
I agree. And I want him to appear stronger. I think he has been totally strong on substance in terms of policy. You know, and I mentioned this also last night on CNN. Chris Cuomo really pressed me about, tell me something he's done that shows strength against Russia. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing is, for the first time that I know of, at least in the history of, you know, since the USSR, we just in the battlefield in Syria slaughtered hundreds of Russian troops, of Russian mercenaries, so effectively Russian troops in Syria. That is not a sign of weakness. That is not a sign of, you know, we are beholden to you in any way. And I don't happen to love our intervention in Syria, but putting that aside, the fact is American armed forces just really laid it to Russian armed forces in Syria. And that is not the action of somebody who is scared or beholden, you know, or somehow compromised by Russia.
That's true. Dan Hendricks has an interesting piece in Wall Street Journal. He talks about Trump's approach in these areas. Trump insisted on these one-on-one meetings with China's Xi and North Korea's Kim and Russia's Putin. Now that he's had that, you know, maybe he needs to go back to the basis that has provided some of his great successes domestically when it comes to things like picking Supreme Court justices or cutting taxes. And that's lean on the experts and the personnel that he's put around him. And in this case, since he's again expressed yesterday confidence in his national security team, Pompeo and Mattis and Bolton and Haspel, lean on these individuals when it comes to the policymaking and even the communication about the policymaking in the international arena.
Right. Again, I think that's a good point. I think that he, and it's interesting, so you mentioned Xi and Kim and now Putin. In all three of those cases, in dealing with, despotic leaders, and all three of them are, his approach has been to lavish praise on them publicly, but then I believe in terms of policy, take a very iron-fisted approach. So he's kind of taking the Teddy Roosevelt view of speak softly but carry a big stick. And I think for the most part, it's been very effective. In this case, I think he missed the mark again, with President Putin, not so much in policy, of course, but in optics and for the American domestic political audience. So I think your point is well taken. Mike Pompeo in particular, I think, is perhaps his best asset in the entire cabinet. I would love to see his role elevated publicly. And would it have been better to have Mike Pompeo in that meeting and then have his Russian counterpart, I think it's Lavrov, in that meeting and have it be the four of them? I think that would have been a good thing. And going forward, probably a good thing from here. Yeah, so I think you make a great point.
All right. He is Steve Cortez, CNN political commentator, regularly matches wits, well, more than matches wits, with the likes of Chris Cuomo. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
So, Dan, I think I found your twin.
Kindred spirit, at least.
Yeah. Arizona State Rep. Paul Mosley. He's been in office for about a year, Republican. He lives in Lake Havasu, so he has to, drive when legislature is in session from Lake Havasu all the way to Phoenix. And he got caught speeding. He was going, 97 and a 55, but that's nothing compared to what he normally does.
130 earlier, you said?
Yeah, I go 130, 140, 120. Yeah, I come down, I was going 120 almost. There was no traffic.
Wait, who would admit that to a law enforcement officer? Oh, yeah, 97, officer, that's nothing. I go 140, 120, 130.
Just being honest, having a conversation with a guy.
Oh, yeah, just, yeah.
Well.
And probably trying to get out of the ticket, maybe?
Yeah, I don't break the law because I can, but because
I just enjoy it.
Just trying to get home, 130. Well. Okay. Well, your logic is flawed for me. I see too many accidents.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Oh, really,
speed
officer?
Causes accidents.
No.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, really, officer? How many accidents have you seen because you had some dingbat who faded into the other lane, into another lane, or because you're doing 50 in the left lane and you're backing up traffic and you're causing people to change lanes and they're darting in and out to get around some slowpoke in the left lane.
You're
How many of those have you seen? How many of those have you seen, officer? If you are a real police officer.
I know why you're defending him, because you do the same thing. Your fast, fancy car there and your fancy friends.
That was
you
a good
go,
one. That was a good,
what do you go, 140 normally? 110? You've blown by me in my minivan where my minivan shakes. I'm left in the dust behind you on 90.
Well, I'm sort of strafing you. I'm trying to kind of force you off the road. No,
it's my show. Get off the road.
I like the argument. Look, I was only the 97. I'm normally doing 130, so 97 is not a big deal. Let's just keep it between us.
Well, he wanted to keep it between us, but he also proved had a point because he is a state rep.
Yeah.
And because legislature was in session, due to immunity as a government official, he wasn't given a ticket. I had no idea. So the officer let him go because, according to Arizona law, members of the legislature shall not be subject to any civil process while the legislature is in session.
Yeah, that's right.
And now people online are demanding that the law be changed.
Same thing in Illinois. That's why they have the state plates. That's why you see the legislative plates. Yeah, same thing here.
How long has that BS law been
since
on the books?
Since 1818.
Oh, when they're in their horse carriages?
Yeah, exactly. They had state plates then, too. Yeah.
Gotta get to
Springfield. Let him go, Lou.
Someone going that fast has no time for a ticket.
Exactly. Why don't people take the Chief Wiggum approach? Why don't more police officers take the Chief Wiggum approach on that?
Oh,
they must be in a hurry. Let's leave that guy alone. Exactly.
So I think we should change the law, not only in Arizona, but we should have an online petition to change it here.
Why change the law?
Because these lawmakers are our betters. Should not have that asset also.
Me.
They can go faster.
These are our betters. They're doing the people's business. They are representing our interests.
Oh, my gosh.
You want to hold Mike Madigan or John Cullerton up from getting down to Springfield to do their good deeds?
Mike Madigan doesn't drive. He is the governor's plane at Midway. He just has one of his drivers take him to Midway. Then they fly him to Springfield. They fly him.
Well,
he's too good to
drive. What about all of the other wonderful legislators
behave,
we have
if you
that
behave,
do drive?
You can get on the plane. There's 12 seats. So
what
if,
about the yeah, well, okay. that there's 177 members of the
yeah,
General Assembly. What about the ones who drive? They're all
they should drive
treasures.
They should drive responsibly and safely. There's no need to go 140
oh, really?
Miles per hour. Well, my car can't even go past 90.
65? How do you know 65 is the safest speed? Give me the evidentiary support for it.
I don't know.
Ooh.
Well, they say if you drive slower, you have less accidents.
Sure. If you're standing still in your driveway, you're much less likely to be in an accident. Well, what kind of sense does that make? This is the whole, you want to eliminate accidents on the road, do you? Okay.
Yeah,
5 mile an hour speed limits and a police officer every mile and, you know, hammering everybody. So it'll take 4 hours to go 15 miles. But hey, everybody will be safe, no accidents. We make these trade-offs between safety and convenience, safety and quality of life all the time, and it's only the demagogue politician or even sometimes police officer who doesn't understand that or pretends they don't. We do it all the time.
Fine.
So just live with it and get out of my way and out of the left lane.
We do agree on that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and we're not done hearing from Alexandria. Octavia, Ocasio-Cortez, that is. AOC.
AOC, okay.
A to the O to the C. She, we talked about some of her musings on Middle East policy as she's going to be a member of Congress come January. She also held forth on the performance of the economy at present and how some of the good unemployment numbers, growth numbers, are quite misleading. Boston University grad Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Now, the economy is going pretty strong, right? There's roughly 4% unemployment, 3.9% unemployment. Do you think that capitalism has failed to deliver for working class Americans or is no longer the best vehicle for working class Americans?
Well, I think the numbers that you just talked about is part of the problem, right? Because we look at these figures and we say, oh, unemployment is low. Everything is fine, right? Well, unemployment is low because everyone has two jobs. Unemployment is low because people are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week and can barely feed their kids. And so I do think that right now, when we have this no-holds-barred, Wild West hyper-capitalism, what that means is profit at any cost. Capitalism has not always existed in the world, and it will not always exist in the world.
And it's those kind of Leninist answers that pushed Joe Lieberman to pen an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal we discussed yesterday and to appear with Charles Payne on Fox Business yesterday to offer his perspective on what the profile of one Ocasio-Cortez means for the Dems.
And if her win makes her into what Kellyanne Conway called the new face of the Democratic Party is not going to have a very bright future.
But do you?
If only she would have gone to Oklahoma Wesleyan University. If only. But then she wouldn't be the future of the Democratic Party because she probably wouldn't be a Democrat. Dr. Everett Piper, the president of the aforesaid Oklahoma Wesleyan University, also the author of Not a Daycare, The Devastating Consequences of Abandoning the Truth, joins us now. Dr. Piper, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
So what about, though, the the celebration of socialism and most of the energy, if it's not from a septuagenarian from Vermont, it's coming from young people and including on college campuses.
Well, frankly, there's reason to be worried. You all have seen the data. You've probably reported on it, where when you ask the millennial generation what they think of capitalism versus socialism, over 50% of them favor socialism. So what she's saying is a parroting of what her generation apparently believes in right now. Now, can we hope and pray that as they get older, they'll get smarter? Yes, but do we know that for a fact? Well, we don't yet. So again, it's clear evidence that what you teach in the classroom is going to be practiced in culture. And what this woman has been taught is that capitalism is bad and evil and that socialism is the solution, completely ignoring the facts. And talk about setting up a straw man argument where she argues that 60, 70, 80% of the American public is working 60, 70, 80%. No, what she said is that everybody is working 60, 70, 80% or 80 hours a week. Excuse me. Well, where's the evidence for that? Where is the evidence that people are actually working 80 hours a week and therefore are being taken advantage of by capitalism? I can tell you the millennials that I know are making decisions, personal decisions, to make $35,000 a year working in a coffee shop rather than getting involved in a meaningful career that will actually move them up the ladder so that they can be more financially successful in life. And they're happy with that. They want to have their lattes and they want to have their free time and they want to live in their cool little bungalows in the inner city right now, making $35,000 a year rather than getting engaged in moving up the ladder. Now, that's their decision. It's not mine. It's their decision, and I can tell you for a fact they're not working 80 hours a week because they wouldn't have time to enjoy their little urban lifestyle if they were.
Is she the future of the Democratic Party?
Well, yes. I'm going to be more skeptical here. Joe Lieberman knows more than I do about the Democratic Party. There's no question here. But I do believe that there is a risk that the millennial generation is going to embrace this particular, imbibe this Kool-Aid, and this is going to be the message of the Democratic Party. Now, will the American public be smart enough to reject it? I pray and I hope so. But right now, we see the generation that's following us in the majority agreeing with this woman, even though the facts, quote unquote, the facts that she just presented are not empirical. It's just emotion. It's just feelings. There's nothing behind what she's saying that is provable. But they believe this because they're making decisions based on feelings rather than facts. They haven't been educated properly to have a critical mind to analyze these things.
I wanted to talk about the quality of our speech beyond the campus, and just, I mean, since I guess the whole country's a college campus now, as some have said, the public discourse more generally. President Obama was in South Africa earlier this week, and he decried how social media is being used for ill ends and shrill ends, and of course it's just a communication channel, so it's just reflective of the quality of discourse generally. Mark Zuckerberg was taking a little bit of heat for an interview he did yesterday in which he talked about sort of what Facebook's policies are for how they deal with fake news or quote unquote hateful speech or just things that are flat out wrong. And he tried to distinguish between saying something that is wrong, and that's okay, because, you know, being the arbiter of right and wrong, threatening language, you know, a overture to attack somebody physically or something like that, which is more of a bright line. But he suggested that he would even sort of tolerate Holocaust deniers spewing their ignorance online because it's, even though it's offensive, he says, I don't believe our platform should take it down because I think there are things that different people get wrong. I don't think they're getting it intentionally getting wrong, but I think it's sometimes hard to impute intent and understand intent. So sort of implicit in that, even as ham-handed as he said it, is the idea that that marketplace of ideas will flesh out the quality arguments from the ignorant rantings. And I just kind of wonder where you think discourse is going, generally speaking, both online and, you know, in public.
Well, there's no question that there's an acerbic flavor to what's going on online. I think all of us have to discipline ourselves not to be caught up in that particular exchange, because it's very easy and very tempting to be rude to somebody you can't see and someone you'll never meet. Don't all of us feel a temptation to do that at times when somebody crosses our path in Twitter or Facebook? I would go back to the Christian ethic. We need to treat others as we wish to be treated, and we need to attack ideas. We should never succumb to the temptation to attack people. Anytime somebody uses an ad hominem, where they call someone else names rather than just address the fact that they disagree with their idea and give support for why you disagree, you've erred. And if that's what Zuckerberg is talking about, good for him. But I'm not too sure I trust this, because I've seen how certain ideas are sequestered in silence just because they're unpopular and not politically correct. They're not silenced because anybody's guilty of an ad hominem. I, for example, have been cited by the Human Rights Campaign and the Southern Poverty Law Center for being a hater, right, simply because I support the traditional family and the nuclear family. Why does that make me hateful? You know, so in other words, we've got to have an equal playing field here.
Well, we can't even use ad hominem against, like, John Brennan. Come on. There's got to be exceptions to that. What about Jim Comey?
Mr. Happy?
Come on.
Do you have to?
Well, I don't have to, but I really, really want to.
So how did you handle the Southern Law, or the, I'm sorry, was it Southern Poverty Law Center's accusation?
Well, it's just a left-wing front group.
No, I know, but did you respond to them, or how did you defend
yourself? Yes. Oh, yes. They said that I was a hater because I spoke to a hate group. And they suggested that the World Congress for Families is a hate group simply because they support the nuclear family. A mom and a dad raising a child is a good idea. Seriously, that's what they stand for. And I spoke to Salt Lake City to some 3,000 people, and I supported that. I supported the nuclear family. That made me a hater. So I responded, and I said, your idea is very bad, SPLC, HRC, and here's why. I, in fact, did speak to a hate group last week, but it wasn't the World Congress for the Families. It was you, because you are so blinded by your agenda that you're hating those you claim are hateful. You're duplicitous in your language. You're saying you can't tolerate the intolerant, and you hate those hateful people, and you're sure that nothing is sure. Sure, you're sawing off the very branch upon which you sit. Your ideas are hypocritical and duplicitous, and therefore you need to stop calling people names, i.e. haters, when you yourselves are guilty of hate. Yes, I'm speaking to a hate group, and it's you.
That's a good response. I like that. And there wasn't even any name calling in it. And I guess you can do it. Okay. Let me ask you this, Dr. Piper. I want to get your take on this. I don't know if you saw this piece in First Things by Matthew Schmitz, Cultural Realpolitik. In it, he argues that the dynamic that Christians need to consider in modern politics is woke capital versus the working class. He writes, Christians should stand with the working class, which is more religious, more diverse, and more patriotic than the managerial elite. Only by reducing inequality and restraining corporations can Christians avoid being buried. Only by challenging the ideology of free markets and open borders can they advance their view of the common good. The struggle between woke capital and the working class will determine the outcome of the culture war. What do you think?
Liberation theology repackaged. It's this. There's nothing new under the sun. Every idea has been expressed before. This is just an old idea of liberation theology, of pitting us against them, of class warfare, of socialism and Marxism, repackaged with Christian language, which is what the left is very fond of doing, and frankly, very good at doing. They understand how to repackage their agenda with Christianese, if you will, but I completely reject it. What is wrong with arguing for the definition of a country, i.e. a border? Why is that unchristian? What is wrong with arguing for personal responsibility rather than government largesse? Why is my argument unchristian? So deal with my argument. Don't throw out this straw man which suggests that I'm being less than Christ-like, less than Christian, by supporting free enterprise rather than government solutions. There's nothing in the Bible that would suggest I'm wrong and he's right. So let's debate the ideas, and let's go back to Scripture as the measuring rod outside of those things being measured, so that we can do some measuring rather than his political agenda versus mine.
But I think what he's getting, though, too, because he's suggesting to challenge the ideology of open borders and free markets. I think it's more sort of a populist sort of almost neo-mercantilist position that Trump has taken, which is to say that our economic system is subject to the authority of our political system, And there needs to be some decisions made, sort of America first type decisions. I guess Matthew Schmitz would be saying Christian first decisions made that sometimes may compromise what the managerial set wants in terms of unfettered free markets and globalization. And is that a direction that Christians should consider?
Well, again, this is a complex discussion. If what you just said means this, that Christians should consider biblical ideas as their priority in discussing a political idea or engaging in a political debate, then I would argue yes. My worldview, my biblical worldview, my Christian worldview informs everything I'm going to say on your program or any place else, or what I'm going to write and what I'm going to think and how I'm going to engage. Yes, I agree with that. If he's suggesting that capitalism and open borders, open borders versus defined borders is more Christian, then I would disagree with that, and I'd like to ask him why.
Mm-hmm. All right. He is Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University. Pick up his book, Not a Daycare, The Devastating Consequences of Abandoning Truth. Dr. Piper, thanks as always for being with us. Appreciate it.
Blessings, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Amy, I noticed a story that's going to interest you because you were part of a nudist colony in Mount Prospect as a young person.
A nudist lived in the house before us. So we bought the house from a nudist, yes. Well,
that's why you bought it, to join that commune.
No, that's why there were so many 49 trees in the backyard because he wanted to lay out naked.
Sure, well,
mirrors everywhere, even every room.
You know what? You could catch up with them on Twitter, I bet. Because it turns out that Twitter is the number one social network for nudists.
Really?
You want to know why, don't you?
Why?
Let me tell you the story of Martin Belcher. Martin Belcher is a 50-year-old customer services advisor based in the UK. He joined Twitter in 2012. He's tweeted out thousands of naked photos of himself hiking, gardening, reading, eating, watering the lawn. Is that a metaphor? Has nearly 3,000 followers respond by favoriting, retweeting, and frequently sharing nude photos of their own. Belcher isn't a porn star or a spam account.
They're not
unsolicited photographs of his penis. Yeah. No. He's part of a thriving community of nudists on Twitter who flock to the platform because of other sites censoring or banning images of their beautiful naked bodies. Twitter is the main community for nudists, said Belcher. He estimates tens of thousands of nudists are active on Twitter, which is why I'm on Twitter's terms of service ban graphic nudity, but they do allow for full or partial nudity, including close-ups of genitals, buttocks, or breastises. And so, it's pretty freewheeling there. Belcher and his fellow nudists also a bit frustrated by how frequently online networks lump them in with sexualized content. In fact, the biggest thing they want from textiles, you know what textiles are? People who live in the clothed world.
Oh, yeah.
Is that nudism is about being comfortable in your own skin and accepting all human bodies, and that's just a lovely sentiment.
Well, I went to Nudestock once, too. Nudestock?
No, I don't know.
It's kind of like Woodside was a band, a festival for 3 days, and everybody was naked. They're very nice. Nudists are very peaceful people. They're not trying to...
And it's not like they're hiding
pants.
Anything.
No, they aren't hiding anything.
So you were nude for 3 days at Nudestock?
Oh, I went for about 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And Kansas was performing, and he didn't know the lead singer. I interviewed him, and he didn't know that it was a nude stock. He thought it was like Woodstock. Like,
you ever seen a grown man naked?
Amy has.
I should share the video with you. I interviewed a lot. It was a fun piece.
Talk about dust in the wind.
And I did a satellite out of Wood TV, W-O-O-D. Wood TV in Kalamazoo. Uh-huh.
Nah, it's in Grand Rapids. It's not in Kalamazoo.
But I'm just, it's in that market. So we rent out their satellite truck, and it said Wood at it. Mm-hmm. Nude stock. It was great. I got wood.
You didn't run into Mike Scott there, did you?
No,
we just know.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.